tunnel of an arching bower. "I don't know if you've seen them yet," I said, "but here is your Celis flower." There were only stars lighting our way, the moon so slender it was almost no moon at all. Under the trellis, it was dark as Denna's hair. Our eyes were wide and stretching to the dark, and where the starlight slanted through the leaves, they showed hundreds of Celis blossoms yawning open in the night. If the scent of Celis were not so delicate, it would have been overpowering. "Oh," Denna sighed, looking around with wide eyes. Under the bower, her skin was brighter than the moon. She reached out her hands to both sides. "They're so soft." We walked in silence. All around us, Celis vines wove themselves around the trellis, clinging to the wood and wire, hiding their faces from the nighttime sky. When eventually we came out the other side, it seemed as bright as daylight. The silence stretched until I started to grow uncomfortable. "So now you know your flower," I said. "It seemed a shame you'd never seen one. They're rather difficult to cultivate, from what I've heard." "Perhaps they do suit me, then," Denna said softly, looking down. "I don't take root easily." We continued walking until the path turned and hid the bower behind us. "You treat me better than I deserve," Denna said at last. I laughed at the ridiculousness of that. Only respect for the silence of the garden kept it from rolling out of me in a great booming laugh. Instead, I stifled it as much as possible, though the effort threw me off my stride and made me stumble. Denna watched me from a step away, a smile spreading across her mouth. Eventually, I caught my breath. "You who sang with me the night I won my pipes, you who have given me the finest gift I ever did receive." A thought occurred to me. "Did you know," I said, "that your lute case saved my life?" The smile spread and grew wide as a flower. "Did it now?" "It did," I said. "I cannot ever hope to treat you as well as you deserve. Given what I owe you, this is but the smallest payment." "Well, I think it is a lovely start." She looked up at the sky and drew a long, deep breath. "I've always liked moonless nights best. It's easier to say things in the dark. It's easier to be yourself." She began walking again, and I fell into step beside her. We passed a fountain, a pool, a wall of pale jasmine open to the night. We crossed a small stone bridge that led us back among the shelter of the hedges. "You could put your arm around me, you know," she said matter-of-factly. "We are walking in the gardens alone. In the moonlight, such as it is." Denna looked sideways at me, the side of her mouth quirking upward. "Such things are permitted, you realize." Her sudden change in manner caught me off my guard. Since we had met in Severin, I had courted her with wild, hopeless pageantry, and she had matched me without missing a beat. Each flattery, each witticism, each piece of playful banter she returned to me, not in an echo, but a harmony. Our back and forth had been like a duet. But this was different. Her tone was less playful and more plain. It was so sudden a change that I was at a loss for words. 4 days ago, I turned my foot on that loose flagstone," she said softly. "Remember? We were walking on Mincet Lane. My foot slipped, and you caught me almost before I knew that I was stumbling. It made me wonder how closely you must be watching me to see something like that." We turned a corner in the path, and Denna continued to speak without looking up at me. Her voice was soft and musing, almost as if she were talking to herself. "You had your hands on me then, sure as anything, steadying me. You almost had your arm around me. It would have been so easy for you then, a matter of inches. But when I got my feet beneath me, you took your hands away. No hesitation, no lingering, nothing I might take amiss." She started to turn her face to me, then stopped and looked down again. "It's quite a thing," she said. "There are so many men all endlessly attempting to sweep me off my feet. And there is one of you trying just the opposite, making sure my feet are firm beneath me, lest I fall. Almost shyly, she reached out. When I move to take your arm, you accept it easily. You even lay your hand on mine, as if to keep it there. She explained my movement exactly as I was making it, and I fought to keep the gesture from becoming suddenly awkward. But that's all. You never presume. You never push. Do you know how strange that is to me? We looked at each other for a moment, there, in the silent moonlight garden. I could feel the heat of her standing close to me, her hand clinging to my arm. Inexperienced as I was with women, even I could read this cue. I tried to think of what to say, but I could only wonder at her lips. How could they be so red as this? Even the cellars was dark in the faint moonlight. How were her lips so red? Then Denna froze. Not that we were moving much, but in a moment she went from motionless to still, cocking her head like a deer straining to catch a half-heard sound. "Someone's coming," she said. "Come on!" Clinging to my arm, she pulled me off the path, over a stone bench and through a low, narrow gap in the hedges. We finally came to rest in the center of some thick bushes. There was a convenient hollow where we both had room to crouch. Thanks to the work of the gardeners, there was no undergrowth to speak of, no dry leaves or twigs to crackle or snap under our hands and knees. In fact, the grass in this sheltered place was thick and soft as any lawn. "There are 1,000 girls who would walk with you along the moonlit garden paths," Denna said breathlessly. "But there's only one who will hide in the shrubbery with you." She grinned at me, her voice bubbling with amusement. Denna peered out of the hedge toward the path, and I looked at her. Her hair fell like a curtain down the side of her head, and the tip of her ear was peeking out through it. It was, at that moment, the most lovely thing that I had ever seen. Then, I heard the faint grit of footsteps on the path. The soft sound of voices came sifting through the hedge, a man and a woman. After a moment, they came walking around the corner arm in arm. I recognized them immediately. I turned and leaned close, breathing softly into Denna's ear. "That's the mayor," I said, "and his young lady love." Denna shivered, and I shrugged out of my burgundy cloak, draping it over her shoulders. I peered back out at the two of them. As I watched, Maelowen laughed at something he said and rested her hand atop his on her arm. I doubted he'd have much more need of my services if they were already on such familiar terms as that. "Not for you, my dear," I heard the mayor say clearly as they passed near us. "You shall have nothing but roses." Denna turned to look at me, her eyes wide. She pressed both her hands against her mouth to stifle her laughter. In another moment, they were past us, strolling slowly along, walking in step. Denna removed her hands and took several deep, shuddering breaths. "He has a copy of the same worn book," she said, her eyes dancing. I couldn't help but smile. "Apparently." "So that's the mayor," she said quietly, her dark eyes peering between the leaves. "He's shorter than I imagined." "Would you like to meet him?" I asked. "I could introduce you." "Oh, that would be lovely," she said with a gentle edge of mockery. She chuckled, but when I didn't join her laughter, she looked up at me and stopped. "You're serious?" She cocked her head to one side, her expression trapped between amusement and confusion. "We probably shouldn't burst out of the hedge at him," I admitted, "but we could come out on the other side and loop around to meet him." I gestured with my hand at the route we could take. "I'm not saying he'll invite us to dinner or anything, but we can make a polite nod as we pass him on the path." Denna continued to stare at me, her eyebrows furrowing in the faint beginning of a frown. "You're serious," she repeated. "What do you..." I stopped as I realized what her expression meant. "You thought I was lying about working for the mayor," I said. "You thought I was lying about being able to invite you in here." "Men tell stories," she said dismissively. "They like to brag a bit. I didn't think any less of you for telling me a bit of a tall tale." "I wouldn't lie to you," I said, then reconsidered. No, that's not the truth. I would. You're worth lying for. But I wasn't. You're worth telling the truth for, too. Denna gave me a fond smile. That's harder to come by anyway.
So, would you like to? I asked.
Meet him, I mean. She looked out of the hedge toward the path. No. When she shook her head, her hair moved like drifting shadows. I believe you. There's no need. She looked down. Besides, I've got grass stains on my dress. What would he think?
I've got leaves in my hair, I admitted. I know exactly what he would think.
We stepped out from the hedge. I picked the leaves out of my hair, and Denna brushed her hands down the front of her skirt, wincing a bit as she moved over the grass stains. We made our way back onto the path and started walking again. I thought of putting my arm around her, but didn't. I was no good judge of these things, but it seemed the moment had passed. Denna looked up as we passed a statue of a woman picking a flower. She sighed. It was more exciting when I didn't know I had permission, she admitted with a little regret in her voice.
It always is, I agreed.
Chapter 71, Interlude, The Thrice-Locked Chest. Quoth raised his hand, motioning Chronicler to stop. The scribe wiped the nib of his pen on a nearby cloth and rolled his shoulders stiffly. Wordlessly, Quoth brought out a worn deck of cards and began to deal them around the table. Bast picked up his cards and looked them over curiously. Chronicler frowned. What? Footsteps sounded on the wooden landing outside, and the door to the Waystone Inn opened, revealing a bald, thick-bodied man wearing an embroidered jacket.
Mayor Land, the innkeeper said, putting down his cards and getting to his feet. What can I do for you? A drink? A bite to eat?
A glass of wine would be quite welcome, the mayor said as he moved into the room. Do you have any red Grimsby Inn?
The innkeeper shook his head.
I'm afraid not, he said. The roads, you know, it's hard to keep things in stock.
The mayor nodded.
I'll take anything red, then, he said. But I won't pay more than a penny for it, mind you.
Of course not, sir, the innkeeper said solicitously, wringing his hands a bit.
Anything to eat?
No, the bald man said. I'm actually here to make use of the scribe. I thought I'd wait until things quieted down a bit so we could have some privacy.
He looked around the empty room.
I don't imagine you'd mind my borrowing the place for half an hour, would you?
Not at all,
the innkeeper smiled ingratiatingly. He made a shooing motion to Bast.
But I had a full board,
Bast protested, waving his cards. The innkeeper frowned at his assistant, then headed back into the kitchen. The mayor removed his jacket and laid it across the back of a chair while Bast gathered up the rest of the cards, grumbling. The innkeeper brought out a glass of red wine, then locked the front door with a large brass key.
I'll take the boy upstairs with me, he said to the mayor, to give you some privacy.
That's exceedingly kind of you, the mayor said as he sat across from Chronicler. I'll give a shout when I'm finished.
The innkeeper nodded and herded Bast out of the common room and up the stairs. Quoth opened the door to his room and gestured Bast inside.
I wonder what old Lant wants to keep secret, Quoth said as soon as the door was closed behind them. I hope he's not too long about it.
He's got two children by the Widow Creel, Bast said matter-of-factly. Quoth raised an eyebrow at that.
Really?
Bast shrugged. Everyone in town knows. Quoth humphed at this as he settled down into a large upholstered chair.
What are we going to do with ourselves for half an hour? He asked.
It's been ages since we've had lessons. Bast pulled a wooden chair away from the small desk and sat on the edge of it. You could teach me something.
Lessons, Quoth mused. You could read Selim Tincture.
Reshi, Bast said imploringly. It's so boring. I don't mind lessons, but do they need to be book lessons?
Bast's tone wrung a smile from Quoth.
A puzzle lesson, then?
Bast's face broke into a grin. Very well. Let me think for a second. He tapped his fingers against his lips and let his eyes wander the room. It wasn't long before they were drawn to the foot of the bed where the dark chest lay. He made a casual gesture. How would you open my chest if you had a mind to? Bast's expression grew slightly apprehensive. Your thrice-locked chest, Reshi? Quoth looked at his student, then laughter bubbled up out of him.
My what?
He asked incredulously. Bast blushed and looked down. That's just how I think of it, he mumbled.
As names go,
Quoth hesitated, a smile playing around his mouth.
Well, it's a little storybook, don't you think?
You're the one who made the thing, Reshi, Bast said sullenly. Three locks and fancy wood and all that?
It's not my fault it sounds storybook.
Quoth leaned forward and rested an apologetic hand on Bast's knee. It's a fine name, Bast. Just caught me off my guard is all. He leaned back again.
So, how would you attempt to plunder the thrice-locked chest of Quoth the Bloodless?
Bast smiled. You sound like a pirate when you say it that way, Reshi. He gave the chest a speculative look from across the room. I suppose asking you for the keys is out of the question? He asked at last.
Correct, Quoth said. For our purposes, assume I have lost the keys. Better yet, assume I am dead and you are now free to pry into all my secret things.
That's a little grim, Reshi, Bast reproached gently.
Life is a little grim, Bast, Quoth said without any hint of laughter in his voice. You'd best start getting used to it.
He waved a hand toward the chest. Go on. I'm curious to see how you go about cracking this little chestnut. Bast gave him a flat look.
Puns are worse than book lessons, Reshi, he said, walking over to the chest. He nudged it idly with his foot, then bent and looked at the two separate lock plates, one dark iron, the other bright copper.
Bast prodded the rounded lid with a finger, wrinkling his nose. I can't say as I care for this wood, Reshi, and the iron lock is positively unfair.
What a useful lesson this has already been, Quoth said dryly. You've deduced a universal truth. Things are usually unfair.
There aren't any hinges either, Bast exclaimed, looking at the back of the chest. How can you have a lid without any hinges?
That did take me a while to work out, Quoth admitted with a touch of pride.
Bast got down on his hands and knees and looked into the copper keyhole. He lifted one hand and pressed it flat against the copper plate. Then he closed his eyes and went very still, as if he were listening. After a moment of this, he leaned forward and breathed against the lock. When nothing happened, his mouth began to move. While his words were spoken too softly to hear, they carried an undeniable tone of entreaty. After a long moment of this, Bast sat back on his haunches, frowning. Then he grinned playfully, reaching out with a hand, and knocked on the lid of the chest. It made barely any noise at all, as if he were rapping his knuckle against a stone.
Out of curiosity, Quoth asked, what would you do if something knocked back?
Bast came to his feet, left the room, and returned a moment later with an assortment of tools. He got to one knee and, using a piece of bent wire, fiddled with the copper lock for several long minutes. Eventually, he began to curse under his breath. When he shifted position to get a different angle, his hand brushed the dull iron faceplate of the lock and he jerked back, hissing and spitting. Getting back to his feet, Bast threw down the wire and brought out a long pry bar of bright metal. He tried to work the thin end of it under the lid, but couldn't gain any purchase in the hair-thin seam. After a few minutes, he abandoned this as well. Next, Bast tried to tip the chest on its side to examine the bottom, but his best efforts only managed to slide it an inch or so across the floor.
How much does this weigh, Reshi?
Bast exclaimed, looking rather exasperated. 300 pounds?
Over 400 when it's empty, Quoth said. Remember the trouble we had getting it up the stairs?
Sighing, Bast examined the chest for another long moment his expression fierce. Then he extracted a hatchet from his bundle of tools. It wasn't the rough wedge-headed hatchet they used to cut kindling behind the inn. It was slender and menacing, all forged of a single piece of metal. The shape of its blade was vaguely reminiscent of a leaf. He tossed the weapon lightly in his palm, as if testing its weight. "This is where I would go next, Reshi, if I were genuinely interested in getting inside." He gave his teacher a curious look. "But if you'd rather I not..." Quoth made a helpless gesture. "Don't look to me, Bast. I'm dead. Do as you will." Bast grinned and brought the hatchet down on the rounded peak of the chest. There was a strange, soft ringing noise, like a padded bell being struck in a distant room. Bast paused, then rained a fury of angry blows down on top of the chest, first swinging wildly with one hand, then using both hands in great overhand chopping motions, as if he were splitting wood. The bright, leaf-shaped blade refused to bite into the wood, each blow turning aside as if Bast were attempting to chop apart a great, seamless block of stone. Eventually, Bast stopped, breathing hard, and bent to look at the top of the chest, running his hand over the surface before turning his attention to the hatchet's blade. He sighed. "You do good work, Reshi." Quoth smiled and tipped an imaginary hat. Bast gave the chest a long look. "I'd try to set fire to it, but I know Roa doesn't burn. I'd have better luck getting it hot enough so the copper lock would melt, but to do that, I'd need to get the whole thing to sit face down in a forge fire." He looked at the chest, large as a gentleman's traveling trunk. "But it would have to be a bigger forge than the one we have here in town, and I don't even know how hot copper needs to be in order to melt." "Information such as that," Quoth said, "would doubtless be the subject of a book lesson." "And I expect you've taken precautions against that sort of thing."
"I have," Quoth admitted, "but it was a good idea. It shows lateral thinking."
"And acid?" Bast said. "I know we have some potent stuff downstairs."
"Formic is useless against Roa," Quoth said.
"As is the muriatic. You might have some luck with Aqua Regis, but the wood is quite thick, and we don't have much on hand."
"I wasn't thinking of the wood, Reshi. I was thinking of the locks again. With enough acid, I could eat clean through them."
"You're assuming they are copper and iron all the way through," Quoth said.
"Even if they were, it would take a great deal of acid, and you would have to worry about the acid itself spilling into the chest, ruining whatever's inside. The same is true with the fire, of course."
Bast looked at the chest for another long moment, stroking his lips thoughtfully.
"That's all I have, Reshi. I need to think on it some more."
Quoth nodded. Looking somewhat disheartened, Bast gathered up his tools and carried them away. When he returned, he pushed the chest from the other side, sliding it back a fraction of an inch until it was square with the foot of the bed again.
"It was a good attempt, Bast," Quoth reassured him. "Very methodical. You went about it just as I would have."
"Hello?"
The mayor's voice came hollowly up from the room below.
"I'm finished!"
Bast hopped up and hurried to the door, pushing his chair back under the desk. The sudden motion disturbed one of the crumpled sheets of paper resting there, causing it to tumble to the floor where it bounced and rolled beneath the chair. Bast paused, then bent to pick it up.
"No,"
Quoth said grimly.
"Leave it."
Bast stopped with his hand outstretched, then stood and left the room. Quoth followed, closing the door behind them.
Chapter 72. Horses. Several days after Denna and I had our moonlit stroll in the garden, I finished a song for Meloen called Nothing But Roses. The mayor specifically requested it, and I had leapt to the project with a will, knowing that Denna would laugh herself sick when I played it for her. I slid the mayor's song into an envelope and looked at the clock. I'd thought I'd be busy the entire night finishing it, but it had come with surprising ease. Consequently, I had the rest of the evening free. It was late, but not terribly late. Not late for kindling night in a lively city like Severin. Perhaps not too late to find Denna. I threw on a set of fresh clothes and hurried out of the estates. Since the money in my purse came from selling pieces of Cauticus's equipment and playing cards with nobles who knew more about fashion than statistics, I paid the full bit for the horse lifts, then jogged the half mile to Newell Street. I slowed to a walk for the last several blocks. Enthusiasm is flattering, but I didn't want to arrive at Denna's inn panting and sweating like a lathered horse. I wasn't surprised when I didn't find her at the Four Tapers. Denna wasn't the sort to sit and twiddle her thumbs just because I was busy, but the two of us had spent the better part of a month exploring the city together, and I had a few good guesses as to where I might find her. 5 minutes later, I spotted her. She was moving through the crowded street with a definite purpose, walking as if she had somewhere important to be. I started to make my way toward her, then hesitated. Where would she be going so purposefully, alone, so late at night? She was going to meet her patron. I wish I could say I agonized before I decided to follow her, but I really didn't. The temptation of finally learning the identity of her patron was simply too strong. So, I put up the hood of my cloak and began to ghost through the crowd behind Denna. It's remarkably easy if you have a little practice. I used to make a game of it in Tarbian, seeing how far I could follow someone without being seen. It helped that Denna wasn't a fool and stayed in the good parts of the city where the streets were busy, and in the dim light, my cloak looked a nondescript black. I followed her for half an hour. We passed cart vendors selling chestnuts and greasy meat pies. Guards mingled with the crowd, and the streets were bright with scattered streetlights and lanterns hung outside the doors of inns. An occasional out-at-the-heels musician played with his hat in front of him, and once we passed a troupe of mummers acting out a play in a small cobblestone square. Then Denna turned and left the better streets behind. Soon there were fewer lights and tipsy revelers. The musicians gave way to beggars who called out or clutched at your clothes as you walked by. Lamplight still poured through the windows of nearby pubs and inns, but the street was no longer bustling. People clustered in twos or threes, women wearing corsets and men with hard eyes. These streets weren't dangerous, strictly speaking, or rather, they were dangerous in a broken glass sort of way. Broken glass won't go out of its way to hurt you. You can even touch it if you're careful. Some streets are dangerous as frothing dogs, where no amount of care will keep you safe. I was beginning to get nervous when I saw Denna stop suddenly at the mouth of a shadowed alley. She craned her neck for a moment, as if listening to something. Then, after peering into the dark, she darted inside. Was this where she was meeting her patron? Was she taking a shortcut to a different street? Or was she simply following her paranoid patron's instructions to make sure no one followed her? I began to curse under my breath. If I followed her into the alley and she saw me, it would be obvious I'd been trailing her. But if I didn't follow her, I'd lose her. And while this wasn't a truly dangerous part of the city, I didn't want to leave her walking alone so late at night. So I scanned the nearby buildings and spotted one fronted with crumbling fieldstone. After a quick glance around, I climbed the face of it quick as a squirrel, another useful skill from my misspent youth. Once I was on the roof, it was a simple matter to run over the tops of several other buildings, then slink into the shadow of a chimney before peering down into the alley. There was a sliver of moon overhead, and I expected to see Denna striding quickly along her shortcut, or having a hushed and hidden meeting with her dodgy patron. But what I saw was nothing of the sort. Dim lamplight from an upstairs window showed a woman splayed out motionless on the ground. My heart thudded hard for several beats until I realized it wasn't Denna. Denna was dressed in shirt and pants. This woman's white dress was crumpled around her, her bare legs pale against the dark stone of the street. My eyes darted around until I saw Denna outside the window's light. She stood close to a broad-shouldered man with moonlight shining on his bald head. Was she embracing him? Was this her patron? Finally, my eyes adjusted enough that I could see the truth. The two were standing very close and still, but she wasn't holding him. She had one hand hard against his neck, and I saw white moonlight glitter on metal there, like a distant star. The woman on the ground started to stir, and Denna called out to her. The woman climbed unsteadily to her feet, staggering a bit as she stepped on her own dress, then edged slowly past them, keeping close to the wall as she made her way to the mouth of the alley.
Once the woman was behind her, Denna said something else. I was too far away to make out any of the words, but her voice was hard and angry enough to raise the hair on the back of my arms. Denna stepped away from the man, and he backed away, one hand going to the side of his throat. He began to curse her viciously, spitting and making grasping motions with his free hand. His voice was louder than hers, but slurred enough that I couldn't make out much of what he said, though I did identify the word whore several times. But for all his talk, he didn't come anywhere close to within arm's reach of her. Denna simply stood facing him, her feet set squarely on the ground. She held the knife low in front of her, tilted at an angle. Her posture was almost casual. Almost. After cursing for a minute or so, the man took half a shuffling step forward, shaking a fist. Denna said something and made a short, sharp gesture with the knife towards the man's groin. Silence filled the alley, and the man's shoulders shifted a bit. Denna made the gesture again, and the man began to curse more softly, turning away and walking down the alley, his hand still pressed to the side of his neck. Denna watched him go, then relaxed and slid the knife carefully into her pocket. She turned and walked to the mouth of the alleyway. I scurried to the front of the building. On the street below, I saw Denna and the other woman standing under a street lamp. In the better light, I saw the woman was much younger than I'd thought, just a slip of a girl, her shoulders heaving with sobs. Denna rubbed her back in small circles, and the girl slowly calmed down. After a moment, they began walking down the street. I hurried back to the alley where I had spotted an old iron drainpipe, a relatively easy way to get back down onto the street, but even so, it cost me 2 long minutes and most of the skin off my knuckles to get cobblestones back under my feet. Only through a pure effort of will did I keep myself from running out of the alley to catch up with Denna and the girl. The last thing I wanted was for Denna to discover I'd been following her. Luckily, they weren't moving very fast, and I caught sight of them easily. Denna led the girl back to the nicer part of the city, then took her into a respectable-looking inn with a painted rooster on the sign. I stood outside for a minute, peering at the layout of the inn through one of the windows. Then I settled my hood more firmly over my face, walked casually around the back portion of the inn, and slid into a seat on the other side of a dividing wall, just around the corner from Denna and the young girl. If I'd wanted to, I could have leaned forward to peer at their table, but, as it was, neither one of us could see the other. The taproom was mostly empty, and a serving girl came up to me almost as soon as I took my seat. She eyed the rich fabric of my cloak and smiled.
"What can I get you?"
I eyed the impressive array of polished glass behind the bar. I motioned the serving girl closer and spoke softly with a rasp in my throat, as if I were recovering from the croup cough.
"I'll take a tumble of your best whiskey," I said, "and a glass of fine Falloran red."
She nodded and left. I turned my finely tuned eavesdropper's ears to the next table.
"Your accent," I heard Denna say. "Where are you from?"
There was a pause and a murmur as the girl spoke. Since she was facing away from me, I couldn't hear what she said.
"That's in the Western Farrell, isn't it?" Denna asked. "You're a long way from home."
There was a murmuring from the girl, then a long pause where I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't tell if she'd stopped talking or if she was speaking too quietly for me to hear. I fought the urge to lean forward and peer at their table. Then the murmuring came back, very soft.
"I know he said he loved you," Denna said, her voice gentle. "They all say that."
The serving girl set a tall wine glass in front of me and handed me my tumble.
"Two bits."
Merciful Talu. With prices like that, no wonder the place was nearly empty. I tossed back the whiskey in a single swallow, fighting the urge to cough as it burned down my throat. Then I drew a full silver round out of my purse, set the heavy coin on the table, and put the empty tumble down over the top of it. I motioned the serving girl close again.
"I have a proposal for you," I said quietly. "Right now, I want nothing more than to sit here quietly, drink my wine, and think my thoughts."
I tapped the overturned tumble with the coin underneath.
"If I am allowed to do this without interruption, all of this, less the cost of my drinks, is yours."
Her eyes went a little wide at that, darting down to the coin again.
But if anyone comes over to bother me, even in a helpful way, even to ask if I would like anything to drink, I will simply pay and leave.
I looked up at her.
Can you help me get a little privacy tonight?
She nodded eagerly.
Thank you, I said.
She hurried away and went immediately to another woman standing behind the bar, making a few gestures in my direction. I relaxed a bit, reasonably certain they wouldn't be drawing any attention to me. I sipped my wine and listened.
Does your father do?
Denna asked. I recognized the pitch of her voice. It was the same low, gentle tone my father had used when talking to skittish animals, a tone designed to calm someone and set them at their ease. The girl murmured, and Denna responded,
That's a fine job. What are you doing here, then?
Another murmur.
Got handsy, did he?
Denna said matter-of-factly.
Well, that's the nature of eldest sons.
The girl spoke up again, this time with some fire in her voice, though I still couldn't make out any of the words. I buffed the surface of my wine glass a little with the edge of my cloak, then tipped it out and away from me a bit. The wine was so deep a red that it was almost black. It made the side of the glass act like a mirror. Not a wonderful mirror, but I could see tiny shapes at the table around the corner. I heard Denna sigh, cutting off the low murmur of the girl's voice.
Let me guess, Denna said, sounding exasperated. You stole the silver, or something similar, then ran off to the city.
The small reflection of the girl just sat there.
But it wasn't like you thought it would be, was it?
Denna said, more gently this time. I could see the girl's shoulders begin to shake and heard a series of faint, heartbreaking sobs. I looked away from the wine glass and set it back on the table.
Here.
There was a sound of a glass being knocked onto the table.
Drink that,
Denna said.
It will help a bit. Not a lot, but a bit.
The sobbing stopped. The girl gave a surprised cough, choking a little.
You poor silly thing,
Denna said softly.
Meeting you is worse than looking in a mirror.
For the first time, the girl spoke loudly enough for me to hear her.
I thought, if he's going to take me anyway and get it for free, I might as well go somewhere I can pick and choose and get paid for it.
Her voice trailed off until I couldn't make out any words, leaving only the low rise and fall of her muffled voice.
The Tenpenny King?
Denna interrupted incredulously, her tone more venomous than anything I'd ever heard from her before.
Kist and Krail, I hate that goddamn play. Modegan fairy story trash. The world doesn't work like that.
But, the girl began. Denna cut her off.
There's no young prince out there, dressed in rags and waiting to save you. Even if there were, where would you be? You'd be like a dog he'd found in the gutter. He'd own you. After he took you home, who would save you from him?
A piece of silence. The girl coughed again, but only a little.
So what are we going to do with you?
Denna said. The girl sniffed and said something.
If you could take care of yourself, we wouldn't be sitting here, Denna said.
A murmur.
It's an option, Denna said.
They'll take half of what you make, but that's better than getting nothing and having your throat slit on top of it.
I'm guessing you figured that out yourself tonight.
There was the sound of cloth on cloth. I tipped my wine glass to get a look, but all I saw was Denna making some indistinct motion.
Let's see what we have here, she said.
Then there came the familiar clatter of coins on a table. The girl made an awed murmur.
No, I'm not, Denna said. It's not so much when it's all your money in the world.
You should know by now how expensive it is to make your own way in the city. A murmur that rose at the end.
A question.
I heard Denna draw breath, then let it out again slowly.
Because someone helped me once when I needed it, she said. And because if you don't get some help, you'll be dead in a span of days. Take it from someone who's made her own share of bad decisions.
There was the sound of coins sliding on the table.
Okay, Denna said.
First option, we get you apprenticed up. You're a little old and it will cost, but we could do it. Nothing fancy, weaving, cobbling. They'll work you hard, but you'd have your room and board, and you'd learn a trade. a questioning murmur.
"With your accent?"
Denna asked archly.
"Can you curl a lady's hair, paint her face, mend her dress, tat lace?"
A pause. "No, you don't have the training to be a maidservant, and I wouldn't know who to bribe." The sound of coins being gathered together.
"Option two," Denna said.
"We get you a room until that bruise is gone," coins sliding. "Then buy you a seat on a coach back home," more coins. "You've been gone a month. That's the perfect amount of time for some serious worry to set in. When you come home, they'll just be happy you're alive."
Murmur.
"Tell them whatever you like," Denna said. "But if you've got half a brain in your head, you'll make it sensible. Nobody's going to believe you met some prince who sent you home."
A murmur so soft I could hardly hear it.
"Of course it will be hard, you silly little bint," Denna said sharply. "They'll hold it over your head for the rest of your life. Folk will whisper when you walk by on the street. It'll be hard to find a husband. You'll lose friends, but that's the price you'll have to pay if you want to have anything like your normal life back again."
The coins clinked as they were gathered together again.
"Third option. If you're certain you want to make a go of whoring, we can arrange it so you don't end up dead in a ditch. You've got a nice face, but you'll need proper clothes."
Coins sliding.
"And someone to teach you manners."
More coins.
"And someone else to get rid of that accent of yours."
Coins again.
Murmur. "Because it's the only sensible way to do it," Denna said flatly.
Another murmur.
Denna gave a tight, irritated sigh.
"Okay.
Your father's stablemaster, right? Think about the different horses the Baron owns. Plow horses, carriage horses, hunting horses."
Excited murmur.
"Exactly," Denna said. "So if you had to pick, what sort of horse would you want to be? A plow horse works hard, but does it get the best stall, the best feed?"
Murmur.
"That's right. That goes to the fancy horses. They get petted and fed and only have to work when there's a parade or someone goes hunting."
Denna continued.
"So if you're going to be a whore, you do it smart. You don't want to be some dockside drab, you want to be a duchess. You want men to court you, send you gifts."
Murmur.
"Yes, gifts. If they pay, they'll feel like they own you. You saw how that turned out tonight. You can keep your accent and that low bodice and have sailors paw you for a halfpenny a throw. Or you can learn some manners, get your hair done, and start entertaining gentlemen callers. If you're interesting and pretty, and you know how to listen, men will desire your company. They'll want to take you dancing as much as take you to bed. Then you have the control. Nobody makes a duchess pay for her room in advance. Nobody bends a duchess over a barrel in an alley, then kicks out her teeth once he's had his fun."
Murmur.
"No," Denna said, her voice grim. There was the sound of coins being clinked softly into a purse. "Don't lie to yourself. Even the fanciest horse is still a horse. That means sooner or later you're going to get ridden."
A questioning murmur.
"Then you leave," Denna said. "If they want more than you're willing to give, that's the only way. You leave quick and quiet in the night. But if you do, you'll burn your bridges. That's the price you pay."
A hesitant murmur.
"I can't tell you that," Denna said. "You need to decide what you want for yourself. You want to go home? There's a price. You want control over your life? There's a price. You want the freedom to say no? There's a price. There's always a price."
There was the sound of a chair being pushed away from a table, and I pressed myself back against the wall as I heard the two of them stand up.
"It's something everyone has to figure out on their own," Denna said, her voice growing more distant. "What do you want more than anything else? What do you want so badly you'll pay anything to get it?"
I sat for a long time after they left, trying to drink my wine. Chapter 73, Blood and Ink. In the Theophany, Tecum writes of secrets, calling them painful treasures of the mind. He explains that what most people think of as secrets are really nothing of the sort. Mysteries, for example, are not secrets. Neither are little-known facts or forgotten truths. A secret, Tecum explains, is true knowledge actively concealed? Philosophers have quibbled over his definition for centuries. They point out the logical problems with it, the loopholes, the exceptions. But in all this time, none of them has managed to come up with a better definition. That perhaps tells us more than all the quibbling combined. In a later chapter, less argued over and less well known, Teckham explains there are two types of secrets. There are secrets of the mouth and secrets of the heart. Most secrets are secrets of the mouth, gossip shared, and small scandals whispered. These secrets long to be let loose upon the world. A secret of the mouth is like a stone in your boot. At first you're barely aware of it, then it grows irritating, then intolerable. Secrets of the mouth grow larger the longer you keep them, swelling until they press against your lips. They fight to be let free. Secrets of the heart are different. They are private and painful, and we want nothing more than to hide them from the world. They do not swell and press against the mouth. They live in the heart, and the longer they are kept, the heavier they become. Teckham claims it is better to have a mouthful of poison than a secret of the heart. Any fool will spit out poison, he says, but we hoard these painful treasures. We swallow hard against them every day, forcing them deep inside us. There they sit, growing heavier, festering. Given enough time, they cannot help but crush the heart that holds them. Modern philosophers scorn Teckham, but they are vultures picking at the bones of a giant. Quibble all you like, Teckham understood the shape of the world. The day after I'd followed Denna through the city, she sent me a note, and I met her outside the Four Tapers. We'd met there dozens of times in the last several span, but today something was different. Today, Denna wore a long, elegant dress, not layered and high-necked in the current fashion, but close-fitting and open at the throat. It was a deep blue, and when she took a step, I could glimpse a long stretch of her bare leg beneath. Her harp case leaned against the wall behind her, and she had an expectant look in her eye. Her dark hair was lustrous in the sunlight, unadorned except for three narrow braids tied with blue string. She was barefoot, and her feet were grass-stained. She smiled. "It's done," she said, excitement thrumming through her voice like distant thunder. "Done enough to play you a piece, at any rate. Would you like to hear it?" I caught a bit of well-hidden shyness in her voice. As we were both working for patrons who valued their privacy, Denna and I didn't often discuss our work. We compared our ink-stained fingers and bemoaned our difficulties, but only in vague ways. "I'd like nothing better than to hear it," I said, as Denna picked up her harp case and started down the street. I fell into step beside her. "But won't your patron mind?" Denna gave a too casual shrug. "He says he wants my first song to be something that men will sing for 100 years, so I doubt he'll want me to keep it bottled up forever." She gave me a sideways look. "We'll go somewhere private, and I'll let you hear. So long as you don't go shouting it from rooftops, I should be safe." We started walking to the western gate by unspoken agreement. "I'd have brought my lute," I said, "but I finally found a luthier I trust. I'm having that loose peg mended." "You'll serve me best as an audience today," she said. "Sit rapt in admiration as I play. Tomorrow I'll watch you, all dewy-eyed with wonder. I'll marvel at your skill and wit and charm." She moved her harp to her other shoulder and grinned at me. "Provided you aren't having them mended at the shop." "I'm always up for a duet," I suggested. "Harp and lute is rare, but not unheard of." "That's delicately phrased." She glanced sideways at me. "I'll think on it." As I had a dozen times before, I fought the urge to tell her I'd reclaimed her ring from Ambrose. I wanted to tell her the story of it, mistakes and all, but I was fairly certain the romantic impact of my gesture would be diminished by the end of the story, where I'd effectively pawned the ring before I left Imre. Better to keep it a secret for now, I thought, and surprise her with the ring itself. "So what would you think," I asked, "of having Mayor Alvaron for your patron?" Denna stopped walking and turned to look at me. "What?" I'm currently in his good graces, I said, and he owes me a favor or two. I know you've been looking for a patron.
I have a patron, she said firmly. One I've earned on my own.
You have half a patron, I protested. Where's your writ of patronage? Your Master Ash might be able to give you some financial support, but the more important half of a patron is their name. It's like armor. It's like a key that opens. I know how a patronage works, Denna said, cutting me off. Then you know yours is shortchanging you, I said. If the mayor had been your patron when things went wrong at that wedding, no one in that shabby little town would have dared to raise their voice to you, let alone their hand. Even from 1,000 miles away, the mayor's name would have protected you. He would have kept you safe.
A patron can offer more than a name and money, Denna said with an edge to her voice. I'm fine without the shelter of a title, and honestly, I'd be irritated if some man wanted to dress me in his colors. My patron gives me other things. He knows things I need to know. She gave me an irritated look as she flicked her hair over her shoulder. I've told you all this before. I'm content with him for now.
Why not have both? I suggested. The mayor in public and your master Ash in secret. Surely he couldn't object to that. Alvaron could probably even look into this other fellow for you. Make sure he's not trying to win you with false... Denna gave me a horrified look.
No! God, no!
She turned to me, her expression earnest.
Promise me you won't try to find out anything about him. It could ruin everything. You're the only one I've told in all the wide world, but he'd be furious if he knew I'd mention him to anyone.
I felt a bizarre glow of pride at this. If you'd really rather I not... Denna stopped walking and set her harp case down on the cobblestones, where it made a hollow thump. Her expression was deadly serious.
Promise me.
I probably wouldn't have agreed if I hadn't spent half the previous night following her around the city with the hope of discovering this very thing. But I had. Then I'd eavesdropped on her, too. So today I was practically sweating with guilt.
I promise, I said.
When her anxious look didn't evaporate, I added, Don't you trust me? I'll swear it, if that will set your mind at ease.
What would you swear it on? She asked, beginning to smile again. What's important enough that it will hold you to your word?
My name and my power, I said.
You are many things, she said dryly, but you are not Tamerlan the Great.
My good right hand? I suggested.
Only one hand?
She asked, playfulness creeping back into her tone. She reached out and took both of my hands in her own, turning them over and making a show of inspecting them closely.
I like the left one better, she decided. Swear by that one.
My good left hand? I asked dubiously.
Fine, she said. The right. You're such a traditionalist.
I swear I won't attempt to uncover your patron, I said bitterly. I swear it on my name and my power. I swear it by my good left hand. I swear it by the ever-moving moon.
Denna peered at me closely, as if she wasn't sure if I was mocking her. Fine, she said with a shrug, picking up her harp. Consider me reassured.
We started walking again, moving through the western gates and into the countryside. The silence between us stretched, starting to grow uncomfortable. Worried things would grow awkward, I said the first thing that came to mind.
So, are there any new men in your life?
Denna chuckled low in her throat.
Now you sound like Master Ash. He's always asking after them. He doesn't think any of my suitors are good enough for me.
I couldn't agree more, but decided it wouldn't be prudent to say so. And what does he think of me?
What? She asked, confused. Oh, he doesn't know about you. She said. Why would he?
I tried to give a nonchalant shrug, but I couldn't have been very convincing as she burst out laughing.
Poor Kvothe, I'm teasing you. I only tell him about the ones that come prowling around, panting and sniffing like dogs. You're not like them. You've always been different.
I've always prided myself on my lack of panting and sniffing. Denna turned her shoulder and let her swinging harp bump me playfully. You know what I mean. They come and go with little gain or loss. You are the gold behind the wind-blown dross. Master Ash might think he has a right to know about my personal affairs, my comings and goings. She scowled a bit, but he doesn't. I'm willing to concede some of that, for now. She reached out and took hold of my upper arm possessively. But you are not part of the bargain, she said, her voice almost fierce. You are mine. Mine alone. I don't intend to share you. The momentary tension passed, and we walked the wide west road away from Severin, laughing and talking of small things. Half a mile past the city's last inn was a quiet patch of trees with a single tall graystone nestled in its center. We had found it while searching for wild strawberries, and it had become one of our favorite places to escape the noise and stink of the city. Denna sat at the base of the graystone and put her back against it. Then she brought her harp out of its case and pulled it close to her chest, causing her dress to gather and expose a scandalous amount of leg. She arched an eyebrow at me and smirked as if she knew exactly what I was thinking. "Nice harp," I said casually. She snorted indelicately. I sat where I was, sprawling comfortably on the long, cool grass. I tugged a few strands of it out of the ground and idly began to twist them together into a braid. Honestly, I was nervous. While we had spent a great deal of time together over the last month, I'd never heard Denna play anything of her own creation. We had sung together, and I knew she had a voice like honey on warm bread. I knew her fingers were sure, and she had a musician's timing. But writing a song isn't the same as playing one. What if hers wasn't any good? What would I say? Denna spread her fingers to the strings, and my worries faded to the background. I've always found something powerfully erotic about the way a woman puts her hands to a harp. She began a rolling gliss down the strings from high to low. The sound of it was like hammers on bells, like water over stones, like birdsong through the air. She stopped and tuned a string, plucked, tuned. She struck a sharp chord, a hard chord, a lingering chord, then turned to look at me, flexing her fingers nervously. "Are you ready?" "You're incredible," I said. I saw her flush a little, then brush her hair back to hide her reaction. "Fool, I haven't played you anything yet." "You're incredible all the same." "Hush." She struck a hard chord and let it fade into a quiet melody. As it rose and fell, she spoke the introduction to her song. I was surprised at such a traditional opening. Surprised, but pleased. Old ways are best. "Gather round and listen well, for I've a tale of tragedy to tell. I sing of subtle shadow spread across a land, and of the man who turned his hand toward a purpose few could bear. Fair Lanre, stripped of wife, of life, of pride, still never from his purpose swayed, who fought the tide and fell and was betrayed." At first, it was her voice that caught my breath. Then it was the music. But before 10 lines had passed her lips, I was stunned for different reasons. She sang the story of Myr Tarinial's fall, of Lanre's betrayal. It was the story I had heard from Scarpi in Tarbian. But Denna's version was different. In her song, Lanre was painted in tragic tones, a hero wrongly used. Salito's words were cruel and biting. Myr Tarinial a warren that was better for the purifying fire. Lanre was no traitor, but a fallen hero. So much depends upon where you stop a story, and hers ended when Lanre was cursed by Salito's. It was the perfect ending for a tragedy. In her story, Lanre was wronged, misunderstood. Salitos was a tyrant, an insane monster who tore out his own eye in fury at Lanre's clever trickery. It was dreadfully, painfully wrong. Despite this, it had the first glimmers of beauty to it. The chords well chosen, the rhyme subtle and strong. The song was very fresh, and there were rough patches aplenty, but I could feel the shape of it. I saw what it could become. It would turn men's minds. They would sing it.